The story you're about to enjoy is a factual tale, read to you from a fictional location. We believe.
Madam, I have here a written invitation. Would you prefer it burned now or later?
Oh, is it from the Seers Guild, Mr. Darling? I've been waiting forever to be invited to one of their gatherings. Write back directly and tell them I'd be delighted to attend.
It's from the village church, madam, from a Mrs. Foolidge.
Ugh, that's the minister's wife. Do you know she accosted me in the cemetery the other morning? We were both there for obviously different reasons, and she trapped me into a 2-minute conversation. Very rude woman.
Leave it to me, madam. I shall redo the handwriting exactly and mail it off to her sister, whom she does not speak to.
The sister who was engaged to the minister first, but then became an exotic dancer instead?
Precisely.
Perfect. Welcome to the Midnight Library, my dear guests. Thank you for coming. For those of you who may be new, I'm your humble host, Miranda Merrick. We're so pleased to have you in for a visit on this dreary night. We're also pleased that you're alive. Not that we would hold it against you if you weren't, mind you. It's just more conducive to storytelling if you are alive, that is. I don't pretend to know how the majority of you feel about being personally tended to. You know the sort of thing. Being handled by others. The various treatments to one's body. Therapies for the skin and nails. The grooming of one's hair, etc. I can only state that, for myself, I hardly ever allow anyone within the 5-foot mark of my person. And even then, it's under strict traditional and ritualistic guidelines. My own family physician, Dr. Bombay, receives only encrypted ciphers as to my rare health anomalies, and he is only permitted to treat my reflection on the surface of Peril Pond. And no, I'm sorry, I can't give you a referral to see him. Admittedly, there does come a point in one's life when we... And when I say we, I mean you, no longer have a choice in the matter. Once you've stopped moving, well, someone has to move you and tend to you. There was a time in the not-too-distant past, after you had passed, and if you were deemed relevant enough by your station in life, your bodily remains were more than just tended to in the typical manner of death preparations. Your physiognomy, your face, was immortalized in plaster. Your kisser was cast. Your exact facial likeness was molded in mud. A death mask was made. If ever you can manage to get a fairly close-up look at any death mask, museums are known to sometimes display them. I advise you to take the grim opportunity, because death masks are some of the most fascinating objects to behold. Now, in order for it to be a deeply moving experience, it does help to a rather strong degree if you happen to have a personal affinity for the person whose death mask you're viewing. And I'll tell you why. Not only are you looking upon the infinitely detailed face of a beloved person whom you've admired but never met, not only can you see each expression line, each fine eyelash and pore, but you are also looking upon their face as the person themselves never once saw it after their death. I had this very experience several years ago when I was solely alone with President Lincoln's death mask. I cannot explain to you just how Mr. Lincoln came to own a sizable portion of my interest and adoration, but suffice it to say, I'm exceptionally fond of the man and the memory of him. Alone with his mask, a fully dimensional, albeit solemn concrete gray, the form of his actual face, the slim ridge of his nose, the intern corners of his wise mouth, the gentle rise of his eyes forever behind their lids, resigned of their purpose. Let's move on, shall we? Of course, in ancient times, reaching back to the pharaohs of Egypt, masks of their likeness were formed out of gold and placed on their mummies inside their sarcophagus. But this was only a representation of their likeness, and was often not so much exact as it was flattering in its depiction. Forward in history, it became desirable to preserve an important or notable person's true countenance after their death, in order to immortalize them in portraits, on coinage, or as carved busts and statues, along with a very detailed mask which actually appears to be a bust of the writer Dante, a 14th-century mask of King Edward III of England, is one of the oldest known European death masks to have been made. It was created at the time of his death in 1377. What survives now is a wooden carving based on that mask. The carving gives him an unrealistic, doll-like appearance. Let's explore the intimate process of the making of a death mask just a bit. Skin, in general, although it may seem quite durable, is actually a rather delicate structure, even when it's plumply alive and flushed with blood. It can be stretched, pierced, punctured, and even torn. In death, however, the sallow, deflated skin is even more fragile and at risk for easy destruction. For this reason, before a death mask could be made, the dead person's face and often a great portion of their head and neck had to be coated with oil. This would prevent the skin from becoming attached to and possibly damaged by the thick wax or plaster applied to it for the mask-making process. Initially, thin coatings of damp plaster were meticulously brush-applied to every minute shape and fold of the person's face, often including the intricate turnings of the ears and even the inside of the nostrils. Over and over again, the plaster is applied in thin layers until the desired thickness of the mask is achieved. Embedded within the layers of the drying plaster, lengths of string or thread were included to be used as a method to gently lift and remove the mask from the deceased person's face. Once removed, what was created was a concave cast of the face of the person. The solid cast was then used to make a mold which would be filled with wet plaster or wax to create a three-dimensional exact replica of the dead person. As long as the master mold was available, death masks of the person could continue to be made. In many cases, more than one mold of the deceased person's face might be created if subtle changes were made to the person's expression. The more bold examples, such as one mask with their full complement of facial hair and another mask with their face cleanly shaven. These masks are what one sees in museums, private collections, or in some cases, even libraries. Authors, composers, kings, poets, heroes, and even villains, some of the most famed figures from history have had their faces immortalized in this fashion. Mary, Queen of Scots, beheaded in 1587, whose daintily featured mask is tinted with warm flesh tones and affixed with red hair and a delicate lace bonnet. Isaac Newton from 1727, looking decidedly terse. The composer Brahms sports a Van Dyck beard and mustache, a curiously crooked nose, and a pronounced seam on the surface of the mask that divides his face directly in two. Poet William Blake has a final expression of what might be interpreted as misery or frustration. Beethoven, who had at least two masks, one looking more like a smooth sculpture, his lips apart make it look as though he's speaking. Dante's mask in 1321 was created with him wearing a flowing medieval cap, complete with ear flaps and dangling ties. And what is believed to be Shakespeare in 1616, who appears with great dignity and his eyes slightly open. These masks are striking. And a little chilling. Speaking of chilling, you may like to know that at one time in London's dreary history, it was popular to make death masks of dead or executed criminals. The reason for this was twofold. One was because at the time in the 19th century, the now defunct and disproven science of phrenology came to rise in popularity. And the casting of faces and entire heads of criminals became a way for men of science to have access to and study the shape and bumps on the skulls of these outlaws and undesirables without having to come in direct contact with them. The other reason is more macabre. The death masks of noted criminals were used to make souvenirs for sale to the public. That's right, you could have the face of a known murderer to hold or hang on your wall as a display. Charming. And although it may seem that upon the creation of one's death mask, that this action would be just one of the few steps taken to wrap up the finalities of one's life on the way to the grave, and nothing more of note could then happen to the deceased, there is one mask that caused such a stirring within the hearts of the public, and indeed the world after its making, that it took on a whole new life for its owner. Her face made her the most famous person to have drowned in the Seine River in Paris. But to this day, she remains anonymous. In the Paris morgue, a mask was cast of the face of an unknown French girl, pulled from the Seine River sometime between 1898 and 1900. Sadly, no one came forth to claim her. Her petite frame, neat clothing, and unblemished face directed her cause of death to be recorded as drowning, perhaps by suicide. And while most every victim of drowning, when pulled from the water, has about them a dreadful appearance in all possible ways with bloating, skin tears and slippage, and horrific facial expressions, this girl did not. There was none of this, not in any way. In fact, not only was she whole and undamaged, she was serene, like a Madonna in a Renaissance painting. Her death mask displays her undisturbed beauty like no other. Her delicate eyes peacefully closed, as though she's dreaming or awaiting a kiss. A true, blissful smile permanently rests on her girlish lips. She's been compared to the Mona Lisa, as her expression is thought to be equally as gentle and enigmatic. Called the Unknown Woman of the Seine, she quickly became of great interest to the public after photos of her and her death mask were published, but no one recognized her. Countless copies of her mask were made, purchased, and distributed. When rumor of her tragic beauty spread, writers, filmmakers, poets, and artists were eager to study her fine features and inspired by her nature as a visual muse. Her image then flourished in stories, paintings, and sculptures. And her death mask, the one authentic duplicate of her actual face, became legendary. Unknowingly, you may have met her, even kissed her. If you've ever taken a CPR class and the training doll used was named Resusa Annie, then you have, in a way, met her. She became the model for the life-saving doll in 1950 that is still in production today. In tragic poetic fashion, ironically in death, she has gone on to teach millions of people how to save a life. Maybe yours. Well, my dear guests, this concludes tonight's reading in the Midnight Library. I hate to put you out, but as my mother used to say, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Please follow Mr. Darling closely to the information desk for a bleak peek at some of the death masks we've had the pleasure of telling you about tonight. We promise you, they are certainly a sight you don't want to miss. Good night. Oh, thank goodness the guests have gone, Mr. Darling. I swear I can hear the most terrible crying just now.
I heard it a bit earlier as well, madam. I thought it might be the new wolf pups, but...
The wolf pups are sleeping in my room. Oh, listen. Now it's turned into the most awful wailing.
Oh, then a guest has become lost in the library. Should we search for him?
Well, if we begin searching now, we may not find him, or what's left of him, until dawn.
Ah, but then we'd be up in time to attend the village church service.
Good night, Mr. Darling.
Sleep well, madam.
The Midnight Library is co-produced by Tess Feifel and Astonishing Legends Productions and is edited by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell with music and sound design by Ryan McCullough. Special thanks to Miranda Merrick and Mr. Darling. No part of the show may be reproduced in any manner without express written consent. Copyright Astonishing Legends, all rights reserved.